Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with a bleary-eyed Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for you today. For those of you in the Washington, D.C. area, you know that Jim was the guest co-host on Mornings on the Mall on WMAL, so that requires a slightly early wake-up call. Yet because of Jim's great commitment, he is honoring his regular duties of the day as well. So, Jim, I hope you've got a Jolt or a Red Bull next to you, and it's good to have you here.
Huh? Yes. Yes, I'm ready to go. Greg, Cam, who's this? Yes. All right, ready to go.
All right, on to the good martini now. And for the third straight day, I think, our good martini is a Trump cabinet member being confirmed. We had Betsy DeVos with the tie-breaking vote earlier in the week. Then we had Jeff Sessions, almost on a party line vote. Joe Manchin, the only one to cross over on that vote. And then very early this morning, almost about the time Jim had to get up, the Senate voted to confirm Tom Price as Secretary of Health and Human Services. This was entirely on a party line vote, 52-47. For some reason, Claire McCaskill was not there to vote, so that's why the numbers don't add up to 100. Nonetheless, thanks to the Harry Reid rule change, Tom Price gets the job. And this is great news, Jim, because Tom Price is a guy who's been all over this issue for a long time. He was a doctor before coming to Congress. The bad thing about the Obamacare law is that it just provides so much power to the secretary to have the discretion to do certain things. That was bad when Sebelius and Burwell were there. Now that Tom Price is there, he can use that power to end a lot of bad things. But he's also the guy that's essentially written the replacement bill multiple times for Obamacare. So now that he's in office, we've been promised that this process is kind of going to kick into gear, and he's the right guy for this job.
Yeah, by the way, I was surprised to see Claire McCaskill did not make the vote. Do you think, Greg, we can start up this fan the flames for a very liberal, progressive, Democratic primary challenger to her?
I think it might be starting.
I just wanted to spend money on it. I just wanted, you know, let's keep, you know, Bernie. Is there any Bernie Sanders supporter in Missouri who feels like challenging McCaskill? Please, you know, go right ahead. Feel free. Because after all, she didn't vote against Tom Price, who pledges to destroy Obamacare. That's just a little, that's a freebie for any liberal Democrat out there. Yeah, I continue to kind of be baffled by what exactly the Chuck Schumer strategy was supposed to do. They pledged they were going to stop eight nominees or try to stop eight nominees, including Tom Price. And so far, I believe they're 4 for 8, three of them coming up fast. Only the labor secretary, Puzder, is kind of been seriously delayed. It's, I think the hearing got delayed 4 times, a lot of time filling out all this paperwork. This is the cabinet secretary who hired an illegal immigrant as a housekeeper. That was going to be a little bit of a tough to explain, particularly when you're going to be labor secretary. So maybe that one will be held up. But if Democrats had picked 2 or 3, I think they might have been in better shape, because now, you know, we're now in this endless succession of, okay, Democrats have decided to oppose this nominee, just like they did for the Secretary of State nominee, just like for the Attorney General nominee, just like they're probably going to do for lots of other nominees. I think this kind of, you know, gets lost in the partisan noise here. Tom Price should be a great selection, and you are right. There's an enormous amount of things that he can do almost on day one, or if not on day one, very early on, to make very big changes to Obamacare, including a lot of discretion regarding the individual mandate. He could either lower it, or he could basically say, I'm going to give an exemption to anybody who's sufficiently financial hardship, and basically grant an exemption to anybody, now, which would kind of, you know, really take the teeth out of the individual mandate. Not sure if he's exactly what he's going to do on that, but I expect sometime in the coming months you'll see some fairly big changes coming to Obamacare because of the fact that it's no longer Sebelius or an Obama appointee, but Tom Price now with the discretion that Congress just handed over to the Department of Health and Human Services.
Well, the confirmation of Tom Price is great news. It's probably not getting the most attention, though, this morning, thanks to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, as we shift to our bad martini. To the surprise of hopefully very few, given the liberal nature of the court, it was a 3-0 decision from this 3-judge panel against the president. And so the injunction stays against the executive order. David French over at National Review very quickly issued a blistering response to the court's, not only the decision, but the rationale in a number of areas. First, he talked about the standing now that states have against orders like this. which could even be involved in cases where people are very temporarily deprived of the immigrant's presence. Then it said it had the constitutional authority to review and determine the legality of the order while saying that it owes deference to the president's policies. Then, he says, after paying lip service to deference, the court ignored its own words and dramatically extended, quote, potential due process rights beyond green card holders to citizens from jihadist and jihadist-torn countries seeking to enter the nation for the first time. Not done yet. Fourth, the court cracked open Pandora's box, noting that it will likely consider Trump's campaign statements in determining whether the executive order violated the Establishment Clause. And finally, which he says is perhaps the most troubling, is that in the ruling it says, quote, the government has pointed to no evidence that any alien from any of the countries named in the order has perpetrated a terrorist attack in the United States. And so he says the proof is that they've actually had to successfully carry out an attack before you can actually suggest that there's a threat there. So, Jim, Trump pointed out in a tweet today that the decision didn't even mention the federal statute, which says whenever the president finds that the entry of any aliens or any class of aliens into the United States would be detrimental to the interests of the United States, he may by proclamation and for such a period as he shall deem necessary suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants, or impose on the entry of aliens any restrictions he may deem to be appropriate. So a lot of things to consider here. No surprise. Now the question is what the right strategy is going forward. What do you make of the ruling, and what do you expect to happen next year?
Yeah, on the one hand, a Trump loss in this circuit is not the least bit surprising. I think what is surprising, and I wrote this in today's Jolt, is how much the blurring of the line between is this good policy and is this legal policy? And this is something that my colleague Jonah Goldberg has gone off on lengthy tirades about, is that the world has a lot of things that are bad ideas, but that are perfectly legal under the Constitution. And maybe this maybe you like this executive order and maybe you don't. But the president's authority in this area, all precedents point to it being pretty broad and far reaching. Pretty broad discretion in terms of efforts to bring threats out. And so my expectation was you'd get a lot of arguments against it, but most courts would say, well, you know, we're not here to judge the merits of the policy. We're here to judge, you know, whether the president has this authority. And he should be winning on this basis, whether, you know, because I'm also kind of left scratching my head of saying, well, who really has the standing to raise the charge? Because if you're not a legal citizen, how do you have standing to, you know, claim that this policy has wronged you? The other kind of odd question in the middle of all this is, you know, as you pointed out, that the citation that, you know, well, there's no proof that these individuals represent a threat. What do you need to see to say, okay, yes, you're right, there is? You know, the whole objective of counterterrorism policy is to stop the terrible attack before it occurs. So, yes, if a refugee does get through and commit a terror attack, well, it'll be a lot easier to defend this policy, but the objective is to prevent that attack in the first place. It's kind of the legal ramifications coming out of this ruling are not particularly encouraging or really all that sensible. The other aspect worth noticing, and everybody's been saying this pretty much almost rote since last night, that about 80% of the decisions from this circuit that go on to the Supreme Court end up getting overturned. Greg, by the way, I assume that if like 4 out of 5 days you messed up at Radio America, the boss at Radio America would say, you know, you really got to, you know, you got to change this. I'm pretty sure if 4 out of every 5 times I wrote something, it was totally wrong. And the editors at National Review had to say, no, Jim, actually, it was 2 plus 2 is 4, not 5. Eventually there'd be some sort of consequence for that. To be a Ninth Circuit judge where you could be wrong all day without any consequences. So this morning in my early morning hours, I got a chance to talk to Ken Cuccinelli, the attorney general, former state attorney general of Virginia, currently head of the Senate Conservatives Fund. He said, look, based on this, based on what we know, the administration could go back, talk to Department of Homeland Security's, you know, career lawyers, and come up with a slightly modified version of this, of these executive orders, leave out all the language on green cards that was causing confusion on the first day. And you could actually probably get 90-some% of what you want done by taking a second crack at it. And, you know, now that you know the legal challenges that would be coming forward to it, you could reword it and tweak it and adjust it so that it would pass muster in all of these court cases, and, you know, kind of put the other side very much on a much tougher legal ground. I hope the Trump administration pursues this course of action. It sounds like the one which would be the path of least resistance and quickest enactment of changes that would pass legal muster. But, you know, we'll see if they pursue that or whether they decide to go all the way up to the Supreme Court and roll the dice on 8 justices or maybe 9, depending on how quickly the confirmation process moves.
Excellent transition, Mr. Garrity, on Little Sleep to our crazy martini now. And let's talk about the Supreme Court nomination process here. One of the things that happened this week, of course, is the story that Judge Neil Gorsuch, the president's pick to be on the Supreme Court, told Connecticut Senator Dick Blumenthal reportedly that he thought that Trump's comments, particularly aimed at the federal district court judge in Washington state, were disheartening and demoralizing. Trump then tweeted out that he didn't think that that actually happened, and he wanted to know why Chris Cuomo of CNN, who then interviewed Senator Blumenthal, didn't bring up the fact that Blumenthal had lied about serving in Vietnam during the Vietnam era. He was in the military, but frequently said during his later political career that he had been in Vietnam when he never actually was in Vietnam. So Trump wanted to know why Cuomo had never brought that up. Well, Chris Cuomo was very upset about that. He says the facts bear it out because other senators, even the statement from Kelly Ayotte, has said that Gorsuch did use the words demoralizing and disheartening. And then Cuomo decided to take his victimhood to a whole new level.
I see being called fake news as the equivalent of the N-word for journalists, the equivalent of calling an Italian any of the ugly words that people have for that ethnicity. That's what fake news is to a journalist. It is an ugly insult, and you better be right if you're going to charge a journalist with lying on purpose. And the president was not right here, and he's not been right in the past.
Jim, the media should have the right to defend itself when they think they have the story right and the criticism of fake news is incorrect. But my goodness, Chris Cuomo thinks way too highly of himself.
Yeah, I will give him credit. He apologized on Twitter pretty darn quickly. I don't know whether that's the head of CNN on line one responding or whether he himself realized just what an asinine comparison it was. Do people use fake news as a knee-jerk pejorative for any news they don't like? Yes. Is it remotely comparable to the N-word or some of the most incendiary slurs you can throw that way? No. Should journalists stop playing the victim card? Yes. Is the lack of sleep starting to show in my presentation to today's podcast? Yes. So, Cuomo, get over yourself. I know, I'm sure he feels like if he ever gets in trouble with this, he's got a really good shot of getting a pardon from the New York governor. I'm pretty sure at one point they ended up he ended up interviewing his brother during some snowstorm, you know, and CNN doing coverage of that. And I can only imagine, like, whether, you know, besides, you know, like, nobody at CNN says, hey, would it be appropriate to have, you know, Chris Cuomo interview Andrew Cuomo? And no one raised that objection. And so I was just hoping at some point the interview would devolve into Mom Loved You More or something like that. But...
Oh, not to go down the ethnic road, but as you well know on Twitter, he has a nickname from some on the conservative side that would be Fredo.
And it's not, I would argue that's not really mocking him for being Italian. Very important to emphasize. It's
yes.
Not. I was making the point yesterday in a one of my other favorite podcasts, or one of my other favorite shows, that when people make fun of Elizabeth Warren, we should emphasize, call her Pocahontas, not Pocahontas. The joke is not that she's Native American. The joke is that she thinks she's Native American with absolutely no evidence to support that whatsoever, making her the, you know, senatorial equivalent of Rachel Dolezal.
Excellent clarification. Jim, I think there's a pillow calling your name. Have at it. Talk to you Monday.
Huh? Well, all right. See you Monday.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Monday for the next Three Martini Lunch. Have a great weekend, everyone.